Good morning. Good evening. However, welcome to the 32nd interview for the Outrider podcast. And today's guest is Virginia Pye. She's the author of River of Dust and the brand new novel, Dreams of the Red Phoenix, both out from Unbridled Books. You should go out and grab them now. Period. Anyway, some brief news before I get to chatting with Virginia. And I'm going to try and make this short here because I'm tired of listening to myself babble. But hey, you didn't hear all of the other babbling, so maybe I should. Anyway, this is going to be a busy week for the podcast. After you guys get this one with my conversation with Virginia, there'll be a shop talk with Stephen McClurg. And next week will be the interview with Elise Blackwell. And who knows what'll happen after that. There's a few irons in the fire, which I hope will you know, be struck soon, as opposed to some of the other ones I had had planned over the summer, which kind of just dissolved away. But hey, that's the way it goes sometimes, especially, you know, for the DIYers with the full-time job in the middle of nowhere. So yeah, let's shut up and let's get to the conversation with Virginia, because she's far, far more interesting than I am. And it's a good talk, and I hope you enjoy it. See you on the back side.
No, I think I'm fine. I think I'm all set. Okay. I will I'll try to catch up with you. Here we go.
No problem. Well, Virginia Pye, yeah. Thanks for and I did get the last name right.
Pye. Yeah, that's right. Cool. Just like right. Pie.
Pie. Good. You know, because it's sometimes it's hard to tell. You know, you get sometimes the name that's spelled like it should be Smith, and they say no, it's Smythe. Okay, whatever.
Right. Yeah, just to confuse us. Right.
I always grew up. They always called me Mallet when I was growing up, and
there you go.
That's right.
And how do you pronounce your last name?
Mallet.
Okay.
I always tell people it's a lot.
Oh, very good. That works.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's nice and creepy. They never forget it after that.
Uh-huh. That's good.
So,
yes.
It's all very free form, of course. I think I said that in the email. So I want to just start at the beginning. Where are you from originally? Because I understand you have some missionary family members in the past. So you're kind of have family that's been all over the world, right?
Well, I am originally from Massachusetts, from a suburb right outside of Boston, and went to school in Cambridge, and then I am now have moved back about a month ago after living in a number of different places. I haven't lived in this area for about 35 years.
Oh, wow.
So that's kind of a really interesting thing to come back home at this stage of my life. And even though I don't have any other family members here at this point, but so it's a new home, but in a familiar place.
Right.
And I, you know, I just grew up here in the Northeast, and then I've actually lived with my husband in a number of different places: Hartford, New York City, Philadelphia, and then Richmond, Virginia.
Oh, wow.
For the past 17 years. It's where we raised our children and lived for a long time. So I'm a northerner who was living in the South, and my mother's heritage was Southern, so I was a northerner of Southern heritage living in the South.
Oh, so
and
they,
now I'm back living in the North.
They never accused you of being a carpetbagger then?
I don't know. Technically, probably not. But so there's that whole side. And then my father's side, they were the missionaries. My grandparents on my father's side were originally from Ohio, and they were missionaries in China in the early 20th century.
Oh,
and
wow.
I did not know my father's father. He died when my father was only 5.
Right.
But he had been a very successful congregational missionary in northwestern China in Shaanxi province, and which is where my father was born and raised. And when his dad died, when he was five, when my dad was five, my grandmother, who was fairly young at the time still, decided to stay on in China.
Right.
And she raised my father there. And then when my father even went off to college, my grandmother stayed. And she continued to stay all the way until Pearl Harbor.
Yep.
So my dad did a lot of travel because he went on and his profession became, he became a political scientist with a strong specialty in China.
China.
And he wrote over like 20 books on, on China and Chinese politics. And and so much of his professional life was spent traveling in Asia, but only a small part of my life has been spent doing that, tagging along with him when I was a girl.
Right. So that means you've made the trip to China a few times.
Well, yeah. Actually, I lived in Hong Kong when I was two.
Oh, really?
And had some sweet memories from there.
Ooh,
not
like,
of any.
Like yeah. What? Like what?
Oh, riding on the shoulders of our houseboy, who was a Chinese man in his 60s. And,
wow.
60 years of age, that is, even though it was also in the 60s. But riding on his shoulders through the narrow alleys and streets of Hong Kong, through markets and things like that, and feeling very safe and comfortable just like some fond memories like that. And, you know, I was there for less than a year, and I was tiny. But funnily enough, I never went back until 2014, after River of Dust came out.
Uh-huh.
And I was lucky enough to travel and, you know, be invited to come to the Shanghai Literary Festival.
Oh, cool.
So I went to that for like 14 days or 10 days, I guess. And, you know, Shanghai of 2014 is just so vastly different than the China that I wrote about in my first book, which was set in 1910.
Oh, yeah.
In rural China.
Right.
Yeah. So it's very much a different world, a different country in a different world. And so so that's it for me in China. There's not been a lot of one-on-one contact.
Right, right.
So, yeah.
What did your mother do?
My mom was originally from the South. She was from Greenville, South Carolina, and she was a very smart young woman who also happened to be the May Queen in college. Now she went to Carleton. She went as far away as she could get, all the way up to Minnesota, and that's where she met my father.
Oh, my.
And, she was... by all accounts, like she wanted, I think, at certain points to become like a foreign correspondent or diplomat. She was a writer and an editor, but she ended up raising children and helped my father with his books. He had an in-house editor, you could say.
Do you think she was disappointed by that?
Well, it's a complicated story. And, you know, she was very much... someone, you know, who experienced the constraints of her era.
Right, right.
But she also remained, you know, really, really well-read and found actually up here in Massachusetts and Cambridge and environs a good, strong set of female friends who, you know, they were smart women for sure. And she was a homemaker and
right.
Mother.
Oh, cool. Yeah, so that's kind of where you got it from.
Well, yeah, I had my father writing on yellow legal pads, literally while he watched the Celtics and the Red Sox, and just constantly researching and writing all the time, and my mother sitting over there editing, and yeah, it was in the air, I guess, stacks and stacks of books all around us, many of them opened and left sort of splayed on the counter. And,
right.
You know, yeah, it's in the air.
Do you remember the first book that you really kind of fell in love with on your own that wasn't, it was either read to you or you started reading your own yourself?
I don't know. you know, I don't have that many memories of being read to as a kid, like hardly any. And I kind of doubt that I was overlooked that much, but I was a third child. And I have a suspicion that they sort of forgot about that.
Right.
But the first book that just cut me to my core was Lad, a Dog, which I read in fifth grade. And I just remember that when the dog dies at the end, because Lad is a very heroic, and this is an English dog who lives on an English manor and manages to save people like Lassie and things like that. So when that dog died, I was just crushed. I mean, it was just one of the more upsetting things of my life. So then and now. So I think I got, you know, eventually I got it that books could have that kind of effect. So...
Yeah. No, my parents read to me a lot when I was growing up, but I remember my dad reading to me a book on Davy Crockett. I think it was more fictionalized than anything else. It might have been like a novelization of the Davy Crockett movie that Fess Parker made before he did the TV show or something like that.
I don't know.
You know, and I remember a lot of the, like the Sesame Street Golden books being read to me, but mostly I used the Golden books as skates on my mother's freshly waxed kitchen floor.
Oh, very good. Excellent usage. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I stopped doing that.
I can totally picture that. Yeah.
I stopped doing that.
I can picture my son doing that.
Yeah.
That's good. That is great.
It stopped though after
I was just going to say, I think that it just becomes such a huge emphasis on parents reading to their kids and that it's just, you know, it's become, you know, that and not smoking in their presence. You know, there's certain things that has clearly improved and it just wasn't happening back in my day. My mom smoked and they drank and, you know, it just was a different kind of parenting that went on back then. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Well, it was a different kind of parenting when I was growing up, too. My dad smoked until I was in junior high. And you know, my parents let me run around at, you know, in like a 5-block radius around the neighborhood, you know, without supervision, just on my bike doing whatever. I don't know how many times I got in trouble. And, you know,
that's good.
The day later, my parents would go, you know, someone walked up here from down the street and said, you did this. It's like, no. So, yeah.
Funny. Things have changed.
Very much so. Very much so. So when do you think there were always books in the house. When did you start actually thinking about writing? When did you start kind of doing that on your own?
Really pretty young. Like I was about 10, in fact. And, I distinctly remember writing early poems right about that time. And, you know, it was just sort of an attempt to capture kind of little moments that struck me as being profound. There's something around fifth grade I found where you, like, have a sense, or I had a sense of myself in the world in a different way. Mm-hmm. And I think it has something to do with a sudden knowledge of death and sort of grasping, starting to grasp the loss of childhood and starting to notice that the grownups around don't really understand, you know, that they don't kind of get it. And, you know, it's just sort of basically, you know, it was early, early pre-adolescent angst starting at age 10, you know, so. So I wrote my first poem. I actually just wrote a little essay about this. I just wrote my first poem about a snowflake melting on my wrist and how it sort of represented the, life and death and tragedy of life in essence. And and I read it to my poor mother as she was just trying to make, you know, spaghetti sauce or something at the you know, stove. And, you know, I don't think she knew what to make of it, but she was nice. She was sweet. You know, she said, that's great. And now can you set the table?
Right.
So, anyway, that's how it started. You know, you have a deeper thought and you figure, I got to do something with this. So that's how it began.
I wonder how writers come to the beginning of writing affects how they approach it when they actually reach maturity and start thinking of it as, you know, as an art form or as a, I guess a vocation in mm-hmm. in a certain way, mm-hmm. because for me it started off with a competitive slant to it. I mean, I always like to say I grew up being a pathological liar. Just because what I came up with in my own imagination was much more interesting to me than what was going on in the real world. And then in the sixth grade, you know, one of my teachers, Connie Job, would pull out these worksheets on Art Fridays, and they would have fragments of stories in it, and it would teach you about the elements of storytelling and everything like this. And you know, we would get to write those, and she would pick stories on the following Monday or the following Friday or whenever we handed them in to her, and she would read one out to the class, and it turned into this competition between me and this other kid named Lars Ellingson. She would always spread it around and read other people's stories, but she was always always this, either both of us or one of us always had a story read just because it's always now as a grown up, kind of, I find that I get the biggest creative charge when there's somebody to write against.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Do you have? I mean, what is it that puts you in the chair in the morning?
Oh, geez. I get very, very involved in whatever it is I'm working on. Mm-hmm. You know, and it just starts to matter to me, and I start, you know, thinking about the characters, and I start caring about it, wanting to, I don't know, just keep polishing it and improving it. And, you know, the language starts to get in my ear, and I start to want to mess around with it. Or, you know, maybe there's some issue I haven't figured out with the storyline or something. Right. You know, there's always something that needs to be improved and tinkered with, and or just, you know, moving forward with the story. So, when I haven't yet started something, then I just start, an idea starts to form, and I don't quite know what to do with it. And then I just have to start writing it. Even, I'm not somebody who can preconceive of a whole, you know, where I'm going with something until I just start seeing it on the page.
Right. Right. So no outlines and pre-planning, really.
Well, actually, weirdly enough, I did do outlines for both River of Dust and Dreams of the Red Phoenix.
Really?
And I stuck to them pretty closely in a way. I veered off of them some, but I did, because I hadn't done that with previous novels, but I did in these cases, and I'm kind of glad I did, because I decided I really wanted to have stories where a lot happened, one thing after the next. And so in a way, those were fairly easy to chart, because you could actually chart actions. You know, this will happen in this chapter, and then this will happen in this chapter. And, you know, this person gets kidnapped here. And then what does that lead to? You know, well, it's going to lead to something else, you know, something big. And so then you got to figure out. And so that's easy to think about in advance. It's then what goes on in the characters' heads and what you want the reader to like take from that experience. That's what has to come out in the writing.
Right.
You know, that's not all spelled out on 3x5 cards.
Right. So. And you didn't find doing an outline like that limiting or restricting, or was by putting that restriction on you the thing that opened up, you know, that they always say that, you know, putting the limitations, putting restrictions on things tends to fire creativity because you have those boundaries. Was that what you found with it?
Yeah, I guess so. And it did not feel, I was excited about the storylines of each of them. You know, it sort of, you know, sort of like, oh, cool. She's going to have to deal with that now. Now what's she going to do? You know,
what
do you do if you're, you know, taken into captivity or, you know, something like that? What's going to happen next? And then, to me, it was sort of freeing in a way, because I could see, you know, it goes back to the old, like, Odyssey thing, where you just get to see character based on action, you know? You put your character in a place where they have to perform, and then you learn who they are. So
you chase them up a tree and surround them with dogs and see how they get down.
Yeah. What goes through their mind then?
Right.
It's much more interesting than if they're just pacing back and forth in their room, you know? So, you know, you got to.
Which is
it's more fun.
Which is why there'll never be a reality TV show on writers.
Right.
Because
right.
that's what we do is yeah. pace back and forth in the room.
Right. Or, you know, or the classic no-no of starting your book with the alarm clock going off.
Right.
The protagonist lying in bed and thinking about how they don't want to get out of bed. It's just like, shoot me, you know. So let's have something happen and then see who they are. So.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, it made it fun.
Yeah. So who were some of your early influences? Who were the writers that you all that are you consider your touchstones, the ones that who's in your pantheon?
Oh golly, I have a hard time with this because it seems like I've had so many different writers that I've loved reading. But you know, I suppose going back to the 80s, you know, probably Raymond Carver,
right?
Sort of just very much, you know, being sort of struck in the breastbone by some of his stories that were so understated and yet emotional. Like it was that combination of the starkness of the language and yet the heightened feeling that came out of it.
Right.
Less so Ann Beatty, but sort of in that same school. And, you know, and then I've always loved just sort of the really... I really, really loved and admired, you know, Madame Bovary, sort of for the same reason.
Oh,
just again, how understated and, you know, emotionally sort of restrained and yet really moving. Or Chekhov stories, same thing. Just the unbelievable tragedies that get just tossed off in a glance, you know, just little gestures that are just crushing, that the reader gets how momentous they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so those are some of my favorites and, you know, and those are the ones I, you know, would like to emulate.
Right.
So I don't think, you know, that's hard to do, but
to
try to aim for.
Huh.
Yeah.
I've not gotten around to much Chekhov, although I want to, and Flaubert too, of course, because everyone talks about how well they handle, characters internalize that emotional psychological motivation, which to me always is one of the things that I have the hardest time with, because I always end up feeling like my characters are acting a little bit too cartoonish.
Yeah, you need to slow it down and be in their heads a little more, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I haven't read your work, but I'm, you know, but that is, you know, that is a danger or whatever. Mm-hmm. I know what you mean. Yeah.
Who do you?
Yeah.
Who's interesting to you right now? The new people that are coming out that are.
Okay. Well. You know, I'm often really in love with whoever I'm reading at that moment.
Right.
And finding things to admire in it. So I'm looking at my bookshelves frantically, trying to see what jumps out at me. But you know, the ones that are jumping out right now, I read all of the Patrick Melrose and Kent Harouf, and you know, again, those are people who also have this way of kind of conveying. Sort of deeper states of being with very sort of understated language and characters. You know, I guess that somehow I relate to that. So I'm interested. I've just started the Elena Ferrante, you know, quintet and you know, clearly her characters are going to be very, sort of emotional on the extreme. They yell and they shout at each other and they do violence to each other and all sorts of stuff. But there is sort of a way that it too, it seems already somewhat understated because she just spells it out. You know, it's not like, it's not dwelling on it in some way. I can't quite put my finger on that yet, but I'm looking forward to reading and learning from that.
Okay.
So, no, those are some that come to mind.
Now,
I admired the Marilyn Robinson, but not all of them. I liked her very first one, you know, and I'm not her first one, but Home. And so.
I haven't ever been kind of hesitant to pick her up, and I don't know exactly why that is. And I think it might be that, I don't know, I get the sense that, you know, there's kind of an uneven response to her.
Oh, well, I think she's really admirable and people do admire her. I know people who have put her down because mm-hmm. the language is just, in those books, sort of, you know, old-fashioned in a certain way. Or right. I mean, it's just really beautiful, though. It's very beautiful. Those are the books. Her book, Gilead, was the book that made me decide I was going to try to write River of Dust.
Oh,
that
wow.
would be a book that would be in that same era, you know, early 20th century, mm-hmm. sort of Victorian people and mores and, you know, that kind of, you know, voice from an earlier time.
Right.
And so I, it gave me courage to try.
So when did you start River of Dust? I mean.
Well, I wrote it in 2012 and, okay. So not that long ago. There's sort of a long backstory about that, but I had worked on a book for like 5 years. Mm-hmm. It was about an American family with ties to China, three right. generations of an American family that went across the entire 20th century. And I worked on it for a really long time and finally was given some good advice that I was finally able to hear.
Right.
Like key. That it was several novels. And so I actually ended up taking the first like 20 to 30 pages of it and turned it into River of Dust.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, probably because I had had the 5+ years to think about a lot of those mm-hmm. issues and not the same characters even, but just sort of had been in that somewhat in that universe of what those books were trying to say, that I was able to write River of Dust quite quickly. And
oh, wow.
So, yeah.
So,
and then it found a publisher very quickly, too. So it was a very, yeah. very strange experience. So,
well, let me back up just a touch here with that. So you'd been working yeah. on this big epic for 5 years.
Yeah.
And,
this, yeah.
and during that time, I assume you'd been writing and publishing short fiction, right?
Uh-huh, yeah, I had, okay. and that was starting to pick up a little bit, starting to have a little more success with that. I have to say, getting short stories published in literary magazines has to be one of the hardest things to do on the planet, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
I just, you know, it just takes decades to build these relationships, I mean, or, you know, or something. I'm just, maybe it was just the stories I was writing wasn't what they were looking for, but eventually... You know, eventually an underling passes on your name to a next level who passes it to the next level. And,
right.
you know, eventually editors were writing back to me with a one sentence rejection and then words
oh
like,
God.
Try us again, question mark.
Right.
And, you know, and suddenly you're like elated because, you know, it's been a decade and you've been trying them that long and they're finally saying this. But anyway, eventually the stories were taken at various places.
yeah, I think if I ever get yeah. back into short stories, I'm just going to be sending them to the Denver Quarterly for as long as Laird Hunt is there running the Denver Quarterly, because
okay.
we're both Naropa grads, and I know him through that.
Oh, okay.
And so,
well, good.
I think that's going to be, but yeah. I've kind of given up
exploit
on
exploit every connection. No, no, there's
much,
no shame.
It's pretty
no,
much
it's
the only connection to a lit magazine I have.
Okay. Well, there's no harm in that. You know, it's a tough game, but, yeah.
Especially
yeah.
tough stuck out here in Kansas, cause there's really not much of a community
yeah.
here, you know, in
gotcha.
Between the Rockies
gotcha.
And the, and
yeah.
the Mississippi, there's
yeah.
not much.
True. But you know, you can make a lot of these connections just through persistence and continuing to submit to the same people.
Yeah.
And then you write back to those same initials, you know, you figure out who they are. And mm-hmm. anyway, but anyway, so yeah, no, I was doing that at the same time, and I'd had a number of different agents for earlier books, and I had my first literary agent in 1987.
Wow.
And this was 2012.
Right.
So,
right.
yeah, and I had a, anyway, so I eventually, you know, took the advice of, you know, took the advice and finally decided to break it down into several books.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, ended up finally writing that second book and sending it off to my agent only a few weeks ago. So So we'll see if that one ever comes to fruition. It's the same one that's been cursed for a lot of years, but I'm hoping it's actually going to be a strong book eventually.
Yeah.
And River and Dreams of the Red Phoenix came after River of Dust, but it was not it was not presaged, or, you know, it wasn't part of that earlier book.
The epic
just
one
made up out of whole cloth.
Oh, cool.
Cloth, sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
So you got your first agent in 87. How long after your MFA was that, or was that before?
That was right. No, it was right after, at the end of it. Mm-hmm.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so, it was maybe in the fall. I graduated in June, you know, something like that. It happened real quick. And it was a really hotshot agent, and it all seemed really positive. I'd worked hard in grad school to write a novel, and got taken by a good agent. So that was really cool.
And then it didn't go anywhere.
And then she didn't sell it.
That happened to a friend of mine out of graduate school, Laura Hawley. She'd been picked by Joyce Carol Oates for the Best New American Voices Anthology of 2003.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And
that's great.
And she was the Capper story on the back. So it was a great position, great story, and got an agent out of it. And then the agent didn't sell the book. You know, she was couldn't do anything with it.
Was it a collection of stories?
No, it was a really short kind of novella-ish type of thing. It would have, if she had put maybe three or if she had put, let's see, if she had put her two short stories that got published and one other one with this novella, it could have been a nice sized book.
Yeah.
But the agent was having a hard time with the novella, because my friend Laura is very good at these psychologically complex but fundamentally unlikable characters.
That ain't gonna work.
You know,
maybe later in her career she can get away with that.
Right. Oh, but these and well, it was those types of characters, that kind of psychological thing, that when I read one of her first stories in grad school, where I looked at her and I said, "You're gonna be my friend because you cannot be my enemy." And cool. I'm going to steal everything I can from you. And so this petered off, and then she's ended up drifting a lot since graduate school, and is just now starting to write again, which, you know, I've been.
It's very, very hard to, you know, have your hopes raised and then dashed. Mm-hmm. It's almost better to have no luck and then eventually have luck. And, you know, it's there's really so many lessons that writing teaches us and about, you know, persistence and everything else. So, you know, I hope she sticks with it and comes back around, and sounds like she's talented.
I keep bugging her.
Yeah, it's not always about talent.
No,
it's... you know, it isn't. It's really about persistence, and it's about discipline, and it's about a lot of things. And being able to hear what people are telling you about your work.
Right.
That's, you know, sometimes you're not at a place where you can hear it, and you just think they're stupid, or they're not seeing you clearly, or they're just missing the boat. And really, honestly, you're the one missing the boat, and and you're getting some good advice. But I could not, you know, I'm saying this from personal experience, so I know.
Yeah.
I know of what I speak.
Oh yeah.
So it takes some maturity to be able to, you know, listen to what people are trying to tell us. So.
Now, your MFA, you did that at Sarah Lawrence, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who were some of the instructors there at the time? Do you remember?
Well, Alan Greganis and Joan Silber were my two main teachers, and also Chuck Wachtel, really nice guy and good author. So those were my main teachers. It's a 2-year program.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's good.
Any classmates that people might know of?
I don't know. a woman. Well, I'm just trying to think. You know, a woman named Lolly Winston wrote a good book that came out of it.
Cool.
God, I feel like I'm forgetting something. Diane Ducharme was there in poetry, and she's done beautifully. That's odd. I feel like I'm forgetting somebody, but, you know, I don't know.
It seems kind of, this on some level, the question seemed kind of weird, but for me, it's always to me, it's questions that have to do with like lineage and the network of it all. I mean, I've always said that, you know, the great thing about writing is we get to choose our lineage. We get to choose who we want to be related to, either through, you know, circumstance or who we admire and whatever. So, you know, I've always wanted to be related in a weird way between the Beats and some of the modernists, you know. So I went off to Naropa and was, you know, with Ann Waldman and Bobby Louise Hawkins and, you know, all the Beat descendants that are out there now. You know, because one, for me, it's a great way to say, okay, because every writer that you work with, even if you work against them in a workshop, has some kind of influence on you. And for me, that's kind of how I go about in discovering other writers that I like and pointing it out. So, you know, that's cool. And then be able to go back and pick up, you know, a book by one of your instructors or one of the writers you like and go, oh, that's where Virginia got that. It's investigating DNA, which I find fascinating because I love figuring out how everybody and all the writers are connected, how these loops are all there.
Yeah.
That's neat.
I mean, I feel like a lot of things I learned is from reading more than that, more than the teachers and more than the friends. I mean, honestly, I love my friends and I've admired my teachers. And I mean, my first teacher in college was Annie Dillard, and I did learn a lot from her. No question.
Wow. Right.
And, you know, and that really, she really, really, really taught. But,
was that as an undergrad?
No, you know, and was undergrad. Yeah, it's really, really good, really important. You know, it helped me choose my life's path, which was what I'd hoped to do, but she gave me the go-ahead, so that was excellent.
Cool.
So, in a way, I know what you're saying, but I feel like it's more the books that, you know, that help.
Well, that's also part of the DNA. I mean, we learn from the dead writers just as much. And, you know, it was through that I never would have on my own, I don't think, have picked up Michael Ondaatje.
Oh, I like him so much. Yeah,
and,
exactly.
You know, and then I wandered off to graduate school, and my first summer at Naropa, he was there just to be on a panel with Robert Creeley and the poet Robin Blazer.
Okay.
Because they had all been friends. And it turned out that I didn't know this when I enrolled there and when I started signing up for stuff. I didn't, you know too much about it. I got there and I realized that my advisor, Bobby Louise Hawkins, had once been married to Robert Creeley. And that she and Robert Creeley and Michael Ondaatje had all been friends since the 60s. They were all really, really good friends and tight. And Bobby was a big fan of Ondaatje, and he was there, and I listened to him talk, and Bobby championed him. So I pick up the books, and I fell in love with him.
Oh, that's nice.
And
that's great.
And through Ondaatje, I've discovered John Berger and Lawrence Durrell. And,
you know,
and they were all,
those are the people I read Durrell when I was in high school, and boy, did that make a big difference to me. And you know, and that led to other writers writing in the colonial literature tradition, you know, Somerset Maugham and Conrad and, you know, and those were the books that I had in mind when I was writing River of Dust and even Dreams of the Red Phoenix. So, but I'm glad you had that experience with people you actually get to talk to and know. That's very nice.
Yeah. That I think, you know, there's always the big talk going on now about the value of the MFA program, and, you know, particularly with the economic situation that everybody's in right now. Good grief. Just decided to sidetrack here for a minute. Did you hear or read about the Authors Guild report recently on earnings? And that for the first time now, most writers are earning below the poverty line.
I'm not surprised. I mean, that makes sense given the way our world is set up.
Yeah.
Um, yeah. But I never assumed that as a writer I would make my living from my writing. I don't know what, you know, I was just told from the start that there are about five writers who can do that and not to assume you're going to be one of them anytime soon.
Right.
So
yeah,
it's funny.
Yeah. It's tough. I mean, I'm really kind of jealous of my friends and people that you manage to get into the academic world, you know, to get the mm-hmm. the job mm-hmm. teaching at a creative writing program.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've sat down and I've kind of analyzed how did it work out for them, and
right,
and you know, because particularly with Naropa, a lot of my fellow students at the time, you know, we all had student loans. There was maybe only one kid in our class who got out of Naropa without any student loans because he had a giant trust fund, you know, from his mother passing at a certain age that his father doled out to pay for the for tuition, mm-hmm. and the rest of us took out loans. Because they mm-hmm, didn't have mm-hmm. they didn't have subsidized positions there, and the few of us that ended up in creative writing programs, the few of them that did, when they got out of mm-hmm. graduate school, they were married and they had a spouse who was doing something else, so they were able to take, you know, piece together adjuncting jobs.
Right.
And you know, I'm enough of a social misfit. I guess that I couldn't do that. I had to support myself. And so I just, and it took me 7 years to get the first book published. Oh my God.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I understand about that. Yeah, sure.
So, wow.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you'd like to know about anything about the books or anything else? I'll probably have to head off in about 15 minutes.
Sure, no problem. I usually only go for about an hour here, but
okay.
I'm curious. I guess one of the things that's kind of been on my mind lately, and was kind of interested to ask you about, just because it seemed like something. As I've been thinking a lot about the. I don't know. Have you ever had people before? Before River of Dust came out, did mm-hmm. you ever have people saying, well, why don't you just self-publish?
Mm. You know, that was sort of on the rise. You know, it was really looked down upon for a very mm-hmm. long time. And that was the world that I grew up in, was
right.
the one that looked down on it. And so I didn't consider that. And I, you know, and I kind of just, I worked in publishing. I worked as an assistant also to a literary agent, you know.
Oh, wow.
I've been around the publishing industry for mm-hmm. a long time, and it just never occurred to me. And it used to just really stand for, you know, a lack of quality to do that. There weren't as many options. It just meant you hadn't quite gotten a manuscript together that was strong enough. So therefore you did this other sort of last gap thing. And, you know, and I understand now that that's changed a lot, and that people, you know, are choosing it and, mm-hmm. and handling it in different ways and sort of handling their own careers in different ways and all of that. But I was enough from that other universe that it did not occur to me. And also I had built relationships with enough agents and people connected to publishing mm-hmm. and had lots of published author friends, and it just felt like my time is going to come. It's just not
right.
coming as quickly as I'd like. And that was a question of patience and, mm-hmm. and improving my craft, you know, mm-hmm. not waiting, not being, what bothers me is it just is bizarre to me that I can talk to people and they can say, you know, that they started a novel and that they're going to publish it in like 5 months. I'm like, what? And because they're publishing it themselves, they've already set it on the calendar. You
right.
know what I mean? And so I'm just like, okay, this is a different universe than what I'm doing, and that's fine. That's not how
right.
all of it works, I understand. And, you know, but anyway, so no. The answer is no. I did not consider that. So, but it didn't mean it felt very good.
Right.
So, yeah.
Okay, so I'm nearly finished with Dreams of the Red Phoenix. I've been trying to get through a whole bunch of books.
Okay.
And you said this one was not part of your original grand epic. But it does. It did draw a bit. It sounds like it draws a bit on your grandmother's story, staying.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Bless you. Yeah. Yeah. It does more than my the first book's more drawn on sort of on my grandfather's experience, sort of. Although the male the minister character in River of Death is really not much like my grandfather. He has certain things in common, but the character goes native and all sorts of crazy things happen to him that never happened to my grandfather. So that are, you know, completely made up out of whole cloth. So he would be mortified. He thought people thought that that's what happened to him. So I can say with some assurance, even though I never met him, but, but the other story and the other story is also not really my grandmother's story at all. She did not get caught up with the communists. And I don't, as far as I know, certain things did not happen with her at the hands of the Japanese, you know, but she did shoo the Japanese soldiers off her front porch with a broom. And that really was a story that was, that in our family existed. And it kind of hovered in my mind for a really long time. Like, what are you, how did you do that? And knowing what we know about the Japanese in World War II, you know, that seems wild. So, you know, on the other hand, I knew from my father's stories of his childhood growing up under Japanese occupation in Northwest China that the Americans really did feel like that they were exempt from difficulty or that they were not going to be targets. And so as a boy, he could sort of run around past the Japanese soldiers and not be too worried. And, you know, my novel, you know, upset Auntie considerably and, you know, makes it so that the Americans are much more targeted, which did happen to some of them. You know, I read, did a lot of research for this book, and there are a lot of stories of Americans and British and Germans who, you know, ended up in internment camps and, you know, were taken by the Japanese and, you know, they didn't get out in time and various things happened. So, it really was genuinely dangerous for foreigners at a certain point. But up to that point, they could sort of pretend they were okay. So,
What
I enjoy
found
doing all that research.
You get a, So I think I read in one of your acknowledgments or an article somewhere that that because of your grandfather, you have a lot of his diaries and journals and stuff like that about his experience. And those, I assume, have been incredibly useful, right?
Yes, that they were the, you know, they were the inspiration for River of Dust. His, his voice. You know, was very distinct, sort of Victorian, very Renaissance man. He really did sort of quote Shakespeare and Wordsworth, you know, routinely in his writing, and so I enjoyed reading those a lot.
One of the things I've found most interesting about both is feeling like I'm getting something about what the missionary experience was like and what the kind of the religious psychology of it. You know, my grandfather, my mom's father was a Lutheran minister, but was never a missionary. Never did any of that kind of stuff. And of course, when I, when I, you know, hit puberty in high school, I left the church and I'm now, I guess, a pretty unabashed atheist. And, you know, the, some of the way you've kind of presented the missionary mindset feels startling to me in a way. And I'm very fascinated by it. And how close do you feel to what the experience you're, how close do you personally feel to the experience you're relating in the books as that kind of missionary I don't know, zeal?
Very, very far removed. I mean, I'm seeing it through the lens of a, you know, 20th century, you know, liberal-minded, you know, progressive person who grew up in the Unitarian Church.
Whoops.
You know, I'm not...
Still there?
I'm not even... Oh, I'm here.
Okay, yeah. There was a little buzz there for a second.
Oh, sir. Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't hear that. You know, so it's not like I'm like-minded with any of this particularly, but I was, you know, just wanted to explore it. And I'm not sure... I've actually heard from a number of people who are connected to missionaries, even from Chinese people who were taught by the missionaries. I've heard from some people that I got it right, and that makes me glad.
That's a relief.
Yeah, you know, and some Chinese American readers, including Gish Jen, says I got it right. So if she says I got it right, then that really makes me breathe a sigh of relief.
Right.
You know, but honestly, I don't know. And I think there's probably, I probably got some part of it wrong in the sense that I suspect, you know, they may have been in certain ways more enlightened than I'm giving them credit for. They may have been more self-aware than I'm giving them credit for.
But
you know,
I'm sure there was enough
position.
Variety to the real life that it fits in there.
Yeah,
somewhere.
And their position, and their colonial, you know, their stature as colonial figures, you know, they may have had a greater awareness of all of that and what it meant, even back in 1910. I don't know.
Right.
I don't know. But, you know, I was trying to tell a particular story that kind of has that edge to it. So, you know, I had to heighten that perspective, I guess. That's more kind of questioning it all.
Mm-hmm.
So
let's see. When's it's in October that Dreams of the Red Phoenix is out officially, correct?
Yeah, October 13th, very soon.
October 13th.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you've got the third one that you're working on, and that one's the extension from the big epic. What can you do?
That's right. Right. It's called Sleepwalking to China, and it's with my agent right now, and fingers crossed that it comes to fruition. If it doesn't, then that would be sad for me. But, you know, anyway, we'll see how that all goes. There's a certain logic to ending this you know, series of books about Americans in China with this final book. I hope that's what my publisher thinks, but we'll see.
So. Hopefully they won't push you to write more about missionaries in China.
No, we'll be done. That'll be it. I promise. It has such a definitive ending that there's no turning back. So,
right.
And I've got other territory to stake out. So, right. But I'm excited when the book comes out on October 13th. I've got a bunch of different events and I'm traveling to a bunch of different cities. And so I've also recently moved, as I mentioned, from Richmond to Cambridge. And so I'm using this as an opportunity to write to a lot of friends and be in touch with a lot of people. And because I'm going to be visiting, so I hope they come out. You know, I'm visiting, where am I going? I'm here in Cambridge and Concord and Brookline and then I'm heading to Richmond for sure, and Washington, D.C., and New York for a couple gigs, which I'm really excited about.
Oh, cool.
And then
I'll send
south,
my sister
down
out to see you.
Oh, that'd be so nice. I will shoot you the information. I'm actually looking forward to it. There's one event on October 26th that's at a place in Brooklyn called Pete's Candy Store, which
Oh, cool.
is sort of a cool venue, and I'm going to be interviewed there by an old college friend, James Marcus, who we were in writing classes years ago, and he is now the executive editor at Harper's. So I'm unabashedly taking advantage of his success as well.
Right.
And but you know, he's been reading my work since sophomore year in college. So
wow. Yeah.
Yeah, we've been friends for a long time. But so anyway, so that's exciting. That's on October 26th, and then down in Asheville at Malaprops and Spartanburg and Greenville. So lots of, you know, East Coast activity.
Right.
So,
well, I know you have to go.
Yeah.
And there's cool. a couple more questions I could ask you, but I'm going to whittle it down to my one last standard question.
Okay.
That I like to ask everybody.
Great.
And I'll try and get it squeezed in here so you can answer it.
Yeah, that's okay.
You know, every year, the National Endowment for the Arts comes out with that, you know, survey of reading type of thing. And they're always telling us how, you know, literary reading is declining. And, you know, there's a lot of hand-wringing about, you know, what do we need to do to make people read more? And then, you know,
yeah.
they turn around on the other side with Amazon and you talk about, oh, you know, reading is just booming. Look at all of this stuff, you know, that people are reading. And it's, you know, a lot of the self-published stuff. It's stuff that's being read like it's like a literary version of serialized television. You know, someone comes out with one or two books every year to feed this little loyal band of nerd armies, you know, to whatever their genre thing is. And I feel like there's a lot of pressure for writers to either, you know, accept this idea that we're just going to be these navel-gazing, you know, academic-tied art snobs, or we're going to have to take on this sort of utilitarian content provider model in order to, you know, be writers, if that's what we want to be. And so I'm kind of curious as to what do you think that we as writers can do to kind of make, you know, literature more sustainable? What do we need to be doing in engaging with the community, the world, in a way to get people to realize that's fine if you want to read this entertainment for entertainment's sake, serialized stuff, but come over here and, you know, get a full course, you know, 250-page meal that's actually more substantial and actually is artist. What do we need to do to engage the audience and pull them back to us, do you think?
Well, no, it's a good question. I think that it's a I think we just need to change the construct here. It's not really an us against them type thing. It's not that we're doing utterly different things from each other.
Right.
I think that there are literary writers that err on the side of caring too much about language and not enough about story. And I think that there are commercial writers who clearly err on the side of caring too much about story, meaning plot, and not caring enough about either character or language.
Right.
And, you know, a great book is all of those, is all of those, language, character, and story, and the deeper themes that that leads to when you pull those elements together and you have a deeper story. If we look back, you know, the reason why we love the different books that we've loved is because something has happened. You know, there's been a death in the family, or there's been a love affair that's gone bad, or there's been you know, there's been a tragedy, a car wreck, or there's been something in a story that heightens our understanding of character and to the place where we can feel deeper empathy. And that's what literature speaks to. And that's what good storytelling speaks to. They're not like different things. And so I think that if you, you know, even if you look at sort of the books that are more popular now, you know, you're right, there's like candy, you know, ones that are just sort of like, you know, like the big boxes of of candy that you get at the movie store, you know, at movies. And there are ones like that. And, you know, it's funny because if you talk to people, they even know that what they're eating is junk food. Like they'll even be a little embarrassed. Like we all kind of know you're not supposed to sit around and eat huge boxes of candy. We kind of got that now, you know, in the psychology, but some of us still do. And that's just how we like to spend our time. And the same thing about those other books. But if you can just have access to stories that are well told and, you know, beautifully told and have something that grabs the average reader, and then provide more access to that, meaning get them into Target, get those books into Costco, then, you know, then we've solved our problem. But so anyway, it's a mistake that publishing makes, but that also writers make, because I think that you can be a successful you know, literary commercial writer, you know, should be a goal for all of us in a way, you know, like to not just decide, oh, I really only want a really heightened readership. I really only want people who are just interested in very, very refined you know, language or something like that, you know? So I don't know. Anyway, so I think in a way I think if more so-called literary writers aimed for writing more commercial stuff and vice versa,
right.
We could bridge this gap.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's it. And, you know, and that is what I'm trying to do, in the sense that I'm trying to write stories that end up having sort of, you know, deeper meanings, the kind of meanings that, you know, you close the book and you feel a certain level of satisfaction about the things, that, the deeper things that book has made you think about. And, you know, maybe your heart also speeds up because there are certain moments in the story where you don't know if the main character who you've come to care about is going to live or die. You know, and that's not like a crime. It's like,
right.
That's like a good thing, you know, to have your reader that involved. So, anyway.
I almost dropped a spoiler about River of Death, but I wasn't going to do it.
Well, I'm not giving away anything, but, you know, we shall see. You know, but I was even thinking about Dreams of the Red Phoenix. You know, how do you heighten action and you know, make it so that your characters have real challenges? So anyway, it goes back to that same thing.
Right. Be entertaining first and then slip the rest in like it was a Trojan horse.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and you really have to, in this day and age, you know, have stuff happen up front to get your reader involved. I mean, there's an awful lot of distractions in the world and people do have expectations of being told a story. So I don't know. I'm not willing to be a snob about that. So there you go.
Well, cool. Well, thanks for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you so much, Jason. I appreciate it. Thank you for being interested and for sharing this. And good luck with your own work. I'm excited to see what you do next.
Well, I'm excited to see what I'll do next. But I'm looking forward to finishing Dreams of the Red Phoenix here.
Oh, and, good. Good.
And seeing the second book of the big epic, because I like big epics.
Yes. Good. All right. Well, thank you again.
Don't hang up right away. All right, there you go. My conversation with Virginia Pye. Be sure to head over to her website and check her information out. There should be all the information there in the show notes. And, of course, at my website. If you're wondering, her website, of course, is simply virginiapye.com. So give it a look. Go pick up her books. I think you'll like them. All right. Be sure to come back for the Shop Talk with Stephen McClurry if you're into that. And next week, of course, on the 12th, we'll have my conversation with Elise Blackwell. I'll get it out of there soon, Elise. So, cool. I'll see you around. And the obituary. Oh, yeah, cockroach naps. Rattling traps. How many devils can you fit up on a matchet? Obituary.